This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden is back in Washington following a five-day trip to Europe. The trip highlighted the key U.S. role in mounting a strong allied response to Vladimir Putin's aggression in Ukraine. Biden attended the Group of Seven leaders meeting in Germany, which was followed by a three-day NATO summit in Madrid. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Thursday that the withdrawal of Russian forces from Snake Island would significantly change the situation in the Black Sea. In the evening address, Zelensky said the pullout would limit Russian activities, but acknowledged it would not guarantee safety in the Black Sea area yet. And judges across the United States are weighing in on whether state constitutions allow abortions after the Supreme Court last week overturned Roe v. Wade. AP correspondent Mike Hempen has more on the story.
A judge in Kentucky has temporarily blocked that state's nearly total ban on abortions. While in Florida, a judge says he'll temporarily stop a 15-week ban from taking effect. The rulings paused so-called trigger laws, which were designed to take effect after the high court ruled to end federal constitutional protections for abortions. Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis says his state will appeal. In other states, there have been disputes involving abortion bans that have been on the books for generations, but never enforced. The flurry of activity has caused confusion and left patients and clinics scrambling. I'm Mike Hempen.
Chinese leader Xi Jinping will attend Friday celebrations marking the 25th anniversary of Hong Kong's handover from Britain, with once annual demonstrations, silence, and a massive security presence in force. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. The Supreme Court has made a historic change minutes after ending a contentious term. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Ketanji Brown Jackson is now the High Court's first black female justice after being sworn in by Chief Justice John Roberts.
I am pleased to welcome Justice Jackson to the court and to our common calling.
For the first time, there are now four female justices, with Jackson replacing former boss Stephen Breyer. She won't change the court's 6-3 conservative majority, one that issued several major rulings this term. Last week, it overturned the nationwide right to abortion and expanded gun rights. Today, it dealt a blow to fighting climate change, limiting how the EPA can curb power plant emissions. President Biden calls it another devastating decision that aims to take the nation backwards. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr., son of former dictator Ferdinand Marcos, became the 17th president of the Philippines Thursday, successfully fulfilling his family's mission to return to power 36 years after people's uprisings toppled his father. The 64-year-old Marcos ran on a campaign of national unity, which was an invitation to forget the atrocities of his father's dictatorial regime. Critics say Marcos' May victory can be attributed to decades-long historical revisionism efforts by the family and massive disinformation on social media platforms. President Rodrigo Duterte skipped the inauguration, but the two met inside the palace before the swearing-in. The World Health Organization says the number of coronavirus cases rose by 18% in the last week, with more than 4.1 million new cases reported globally. The UN health agency said the worldwide number of deaths remained relatively similar to the week before at about 8,500, but increased in three regions: the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and the Americas. And weeks after acknowledging its first coronavirus infections, North Korea appears to be blaming the outbreak on balloons sent by defector activists in South Korea. North Korean officials said Friday they traced the outbreak to an inter-Korean border region where a teenager and a five-year-old came in contact with an alien thing in early April. The statement published in the state-run Korean Central News Agency did not specify what objects were, but later warned residents to be on the lookout for balloons and other alien things in the area. For more news, please join us, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
Today is Friday, July 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Joe Biden pledges additional support for Ukraine as Russian forces leave strategic Snake Island.
This summit was about strengthening our alliance, meeting the challenges of our world as it is today, and the threats we're going to face in the future.
The UN warns that Myanmar's military junta is increasing its brutal campaign of violence and rights abuses.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Myanmar, Thomas Andrews, is calling on the outside world to act to bring Myanmar's military leaders to account.
And Ketanji Brown Jackson is sworn in as the first black woman on the nation's highest court. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday pledged ongoing support for Ukraine, including $800 million of additional weapons aid for the country to be announced in the coming days. Biden said Russia's invasion of Ukraine has led to a stronger and more united alliance and welcomed the additions of Sweden and Finland to NATO and said the alliance would defend, quote, every inch of NATO territory, unquote.
Before the war started, I told Putin that if he invaded Ukraine, NATO would not only get stronger, but would get more united. And we would see, democracies in the world stand up and oppose his aggression and defend the rules-based order. And that's exactly what we're seeing today. This summit was about strengthening our alliance, meeting the challenges of our world as it is today, and the threats we're going to face in the future. At this summit, we rallied our alliances to meet both the direct threats of Russia poses to Europe and the systemic challenges that China poses to a rules-based world order. And we've invited two new members to join NATO. It was a historic act, Finland and Sweden, two countries with a long tradition of neutrality and choosing to join NATO.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden speaking after the NATO summit. Russian forces have led Zhiminyi, or Snake Island, as of Thursday, that according to statements by both the Russian and Ukrainian governments. Russia claims the move is, quote, a gesture of goodwill, unquote, while British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Moscow's decision to abandon the strategic Black Sea outpost was evidence of Ukraine's ability to fight back. For more, Flashpoint's Ukraine Miller spoke. Steve Miller spoke with reporter Anna Shenikova in Kyiv.
It was not a secret that Ukrainian forces were conducting this operation. Also, the head of the Ukrainian armed forces, Mr. Zaluzhny, posted today a footage from the drone showing the whole operation. So we can see that Ukrainian forces actually used a lot of equipment. It was artillery, missile and airstrikes to get occupiers out from the Snake Island.
With Ukraine now back in control of Snake Island, does that change the security calculus by Kyiv in terms of moving grain through the Black Sea?
So the liberation of Zhiminyi Island would definitely make it easier to go on with grain delivery because, of course, this is a big part of Black Sea, which is now under Ukrainian control. But again, for the moment, this is not a guarantee that Russian forces would actually let this grain out. So we don't have official comment on this situation yet.
That's 5 points. Ukraine Steve Miller speaking with reporter Anna Shenikova in Kyiv. Chinese leader Xi Jinping will swear in Hong Kong's new leader John Lee on Friday as part of a two-day visit to the former British colony to celebrate 25 years since its return to Chinese rule. Under Xi's leadership, China has reshaped Hong Kong, imposing a strict national security law used to silence dissent and revamping election laws to keep opposition politicians out of the city's legislature. The changes have all but eliminated dissenting voices in a place once known for its vibrant political debate. For more, I spoke with Raymond Yam of the VOA's Cantonese service.
A lot of people are moving out of Hong Kong. They are worried about the freedom and afraid that the whole thing will go to the worst scenario, like whatever people suffer in mainland China, or even some people even compare the current situation in Hong Kong is not a difference than in North Korea. And so this is the problem. And a lot of people also, they are suffer from the strict pandemic measure. You are now in Hong Kong. If you are positive, you need to quarantine to some kind of a care camp, it probably up to 7 days. And people are worried what's going on. And also, when you try to travel to Hong Kong, you are required to quarantine for at least 7 days in the specific designated hotel. And that's why this is really disturbing all the international travel and also the business activity. And so the economy, local economy in Hong Kong are turning down, going down, and people are worried about the recession. Even the situation may be tougher than what the so-called recession in the Western world, in America or in Europe. And besides, when Xi Jinping went to Hong Kong earlier today, there were lots of roadblocks. And so people are suffer from the traffic jam for up to, some reports said that, even up to 2 hours. At the same time, there is a typhoon approaching Hong Kong. At this point, we are talking about the typhoon number 3, which is equivalent as the hurricane number 2 in the United States. So you can see that people are not really happy and they believe that the whole thing is a mess.
Prior to the security law, a lot of people held out hope that Hong Kong will continue to be a liberal city, a vibrant city of Western ideas. What went wrong?
Well, I would say because Chinese government, they are using their strong arm fists to crack down on Hong Kong. And people in Hong Kong, they have no capital to deal with China, because for the past 10 years, a lot of mainland Chinese, especially the state-owned enterprise, are invested in Hong Kong. And so the economy, the business level are getting more and more capital from mainland China. One of the things is because of the pandemic, the regime tried to use pandemic as an excuse in order to continue their crackdown. And Western world, United States and European country, they don't have enough time to deal with it. They are busy to deal with the COVID. But for the situation in Hong Kong, it's probably too far away from them.
That's Raymond Yam of the VOA's Cantonese service speaking with me from Washington, D.C. The head of the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, in a rare interview, has outlined concerns about China's economic and military ambitions. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Information is power, and the head of the Australian Secret Intelligence Service has for the first time appeared on national television to explain how his secretive organisation operates, in a bid to publicly explain its workings as it celebrates its 70th anniversary. ASIS is one of six intelligence agencies, overseen by senior members of the government in Canberra and the Defence Department. It's Australia's equivalent to Britain's MI6 and the CIA in the United States. ASIS Director Paul Simon told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that a heightened geostrategic environment was its number one security challenge. He noted that terrorism remained a threat, especially in the Middle East and Afghanistan, which continued to be a very dynamic and difficult environment. He said he's concerned about unrest in Sri Lanka and potential dangers for people if they fall into the hands of human traffickers as they try to make their way into Australia. Simon said his agency was working hard to keep the government in Canberra informed of China's strategic ambitions in the Pacific.
China has, with its growing power, we think, a range of economic, military, political aspirations. And I think it's impossible right now to say exactly what that end state is or end point is for them. I think it's our job in the Secret Intelligence Service to obtain, through agent access, through people who are willing to share the secrets of countries around the region, what they are thinking and what they are doing, and then share that with our government, but also help the region understand what is going on as well.
Beijing recently signed a security pact with Solomon Islands, a strategically located Pacific archipelago northeast of Australia. China failed to persuade other Pacific Island nations to join a broad regional accord, but it has struck individual agreements with Kiribati and Samoa. In response, Australia's recently elected centre-left government has intensified its diplomacy in the region, promising stronger action on climate change. Beijing said it wasn't in competition with other countries for influence in the Pacific. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
UN investigator Thomas Andrews is warning that Myanmar's military junta is increasing its brutal campaigns of violence, resorting to massacres and widespread human rights violations to maintain its iron grip. The report has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Myanmar, Thomas Andrews, is calling on the outside world to act to bring Myanmar's military leaders to account. He warns failure to take needed action will cause irreparable harm to the population and be a death sentence for untold numbers of people. He says conditions in the country have worsened since he last reported to the council 3 months ago. Andrews says the ruling generals have accelerated their bloody campaign against political opponents, killing more than 2,000 civilians and arbitrarily arresting and imprisoning more than 11,000. He says junta forces have relentlessly bombed villages with fighter jets, killing men, women, and children.
I regularly receive reports of new massacres of unarmed civilians. Victims often include children and those who are physically unable to flee the advance of soldiers and military-backed militias. In my view, these repeated attacks on civilians, as well as other grave human rights violations, constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Andrew says Myanmar's children are among the most frequent victims of this crisis. He reports more than 250,000 children have been displaced by junta attacks, hundreds have been killed or maimed, and more than 1,400 arbitrarily detained. Since last year's military coup, he says 142 children have been tortured. He says they have been beaten, cut, stabbed, and subjected to other horrific physical and mental abuse. He says they've been subjected to mock executions and sexually assaulted.
At least 61 children are currently being held hostage by the junta to force adult family members who support the opposition to give themselves up. 33,000 children could die of preventable deaths this year alone merely because they have missed routine immunizations.
Andrews warns conditions in Myanmar will keep deteriorating if other countries continue to ignore the situation. He calls for international action. He says the Security Council must consider a resolution concerning Myanmar. He urges members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations to impose economic and diplomatic sanctions on Myanmar's military leaders. Myanmar did not respond to the report because the United Nations does not recognize the legitimacy of the current government. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, Ketanji Brown Jackson has been sworn into the Supreme Court, shattering a glass ceiling as the first black woman on the nation's highest court. The 51-year-old Jackson is the court's 160th justice and took the place Thursday of the justice she once worked for. Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement took effect at noon. Moments later, joined by her family, Jackson recited the two oaths required of Supreme Court justices, one administered by Breyer and the other by Chief Justice John Roberts. Jackson says she's, quote, truly grateful to be part of the promise of our great nation, unquote, and extends thanks to her colleagues for their, quote, gracious welcome, unquote. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Fossils of early human ancestors found in a South African cave decades ago are a million years older than previously thought, according to a new study that provides insight into the origins of mankind. The fossils from Stephan Kane Caves include an almost complete skull of a cave woman found that date back to 3.4 million to 3.6 million years. Darrell Granger, one of the authors of the study, published this week in the peer-reviewed journal Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences, tells my colleague Carol Van Dam that his team examined radioactive decay in rocks buried with the fossils.
We're using a dating method that's based on what are called cosmogenic nuclides. So it's a different dating method that has been used here before. This method works by dating rocks that we find around the fossils. So we're not dating the fossils directly. We're dating the rocks that they're found in. And these rocks, when they're at the ground surface, they're exposed to cosmic rays coming in from space. And these cause nuclear reactions in there and make radioactive particles. When the quartz is washed into the cave or it falls into the cave along with the bones, the cosmogenic nuclides decay away over time. And so we can measure how much is left in the rocks and figure out when they fell into the cave. So it's a dating method that we've used before at different places and deeper at Sterkfontein, but it's a new application.
The rocks are kind of like the same thing as where the team found the fossils?
Sterkfontein is a cave, and when the cave was open, it was filled in with rocks that would fall into the entrance. Sometimes rocks would fall off the ceiling and the walls. And at the same time, there are animals and bones that are falling into that entrance as well. And they fell down a pit and then made what's called a talus cone, sloping down away from the surface. And so the bones are found in the middle of all these gravel and boulders that have been cemented together. It's almost like concrete. So to find the fossils, you've got to break apart these rocks and then find the bones in between.
Break apart the rocks very carefully, I would
assume. Yes. Well, in the old days, they were using dynamite. They were mining this place for lime and finding fossils as they blew it up to extract the lime.
So the 3.2 million year old skeleton Lucy, which we all heard back in 1974, was found in Ethiopia. And that was pretty mind blowing back then. So that area was long considered the probable origin of the earliest. Is it hominin? Is that how you say it? Hominin?
Hominin, yes.
Which evolved into the Homo genus, which is what we are. So what does this latest discovery by your team mean in relation to Lucy?
So since the discovery of Lucy, we've found older fossils going back deeper in time. So Lucy species goes back to close to 4 million years. So between 3.5 and 4 million years, we see a lot of diversification of the hominins, of Australopithecus, and expansion or the growth of different species, different experiments, biological experiments in evolution as the hominins are changing from an arboreal, tree-dwelling lifestyle to more of a ground-dwelling lifestyle. So this is an important time in human evolution.
That's Daryl Granger, professor of solid earth sciences at Purdue University, speaking from Lafayette, Indiana, with reporter VOA's Carol Van Dam. Experts in biodiversity have laid out their top three priorities of the post-2020 Global Diversity Framework. Brian O'Donnell, Director of Campaign for Nature, spoke to Ricky Schreyack about those priorities and why they need to be urgently addressed.
The first priority is the protection of at least 30% of the world's lands and oceans. The number one driver of biodiversity loss is the destruction of habitat. And so protected and conserved areas help maintain habitat, which is important to maintain biodiversity. The next priority is to ensure that the rights and leadership of indigenous peoples and local communities are recognized and centered. They've been the world's best defenders of biodiversity for centuries, and by ensuring that their rights are recognized and their territories are secure, we can make major progress for biodiversity. And the third most important issue, I think, is finance. Without adequate resources going towards biodiversity, we won't see these targets that are being envisioned to be met and implemented. So increased finance, especially from wealthy nations, developing nations, is a key priority.
What is the urgency for these priorities? Can you give me some real impacts that are going on being felt by populations?
Sure. In May of 2019, the world's largest assessment of the state of biodiversity on the planet was released, and it said that biodiversity is declining at rates unprecedented in human history, that we are seeing real consequences for people by the loss of the services that nature provides for people, clean air, storm protection, pollination, and that if we didn't increase and transformational change our relationship with nature, we would lose up to 1 million species, many within decades. That's 1 million species becoming extinct, permanently extinct. So huge implications if we don't do a course correction on how we address biodiversity loss.
What are the biggest obstacles to addressing biodiversity loss?
I think one is just that biodiversity has not been a priority on the political level. I think many leaders feel that if we address the climate change crisis, we will also solve the biodiversity crisis. But while they're linked, that's not always the case. We can go to a completely fossil fuel-free economy, and yet we'll still lose biodiversity because we're expanding agriculture into places that we're clearing tropical forests. We're also seeing the fish in the oceans being overfished at an unsustainable level. So making this a higher political priority is important, as well as individuals taking action, thinking about the impacts we have with our consumption, with our diets, and how we approach this is going to be key. But most importantly, we need global leaders to address the large issues of habitat loss and systems changes required to maintain our intact natural areas and restore those degraded areas.
That's Brian O'Donnell, Director of Campaign for Nature, speaking with reporter Ricky Schreier.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Finland and Sweden are on the road to NATO membership. At the NATO summit in Madrid, Turkey lifted its initial objections to these two applicants, and the Atlantic Alliance pledged stronger support for Ukraine as it defends itself against Russian aggression. The outcomes of the NATO summit as the coalition gears up to deter both Russia and China from attacking the liberal international order. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
And to all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington. Have a wonderful weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The right to freedom of expression, including freedom of the press, faces profound challenges in our own hemisphere and around the world, declared Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the Media Summit of Americas in Los Angeles. He highlighted three common challenges in media and what the United States is doing to tackle them. In order to combat disinformation, the State Department has launched the first hub of the Digital Communication Network of the Americas, a network of journalists, civil society, and government officials who collectively can address and counter state-sponsored propaganda. They will also address journalist safety. Another challenge is the ongoing threats, harassment, and violence faced by members of the press across the hemisphere, said Secretary Blinken.
At least 17 journalists have been killed in this hemisphere in this year, according to the UNESCO Observatory of Killed Journalists, including most recently Yesenia Molinedo and Sheila Johanna Garcia, the director, and a reporter of the news website El Veraz in Veracruz, Mexico, shot to death on May the 9th. No region in the world is more dangerous for journalists.
Governments are using legislation to quash free expression, as seen in the recent slate of restrictions adopted by El Salvador in the spring. In Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, the simple act of carrying out investigative journalism is a crime. In response, the United States is working across the region to strengthen the rule of law and train judges and prosecutors to investigate and prosecute such attacks. USAID will provide up to $9 million to support a Global Defamation Defense Fund for journalists, which will offer liability coverage for reporters and news organizations targeted with unjust litigation. And the State Department is investing up to $3.5 million to launch a journalism protection platform that will protect and train journalists under threat. Third, the U.S. is working to make independent media more sustainable, said Secretary Blinken.
We've committed $30 million to the International Fund for Public Interest Media, which will focus on assisting media in resource-poor and unstable settings, and $5 million to improve the financial viability of independent media outlets.
A free, independent press across the Western Hemisphere is more important now than ever, said Secretary Blinken, for the well-being of our people, for the well-being of our communities, and for the well-being of our democracies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.